Heritage Radio Network on Tour is made possible by the support of the Julia Child Foundation.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'd like to first introduce Mitch Baranowski, who is going to be our host and facilitator for the rest of the morning here today, before the break and after the break. Mitch is a wonderful, smart guy who told me this morning that he's been studying the conscious consumer since 2006. So that's 11 years or so of thinking about what people want to do with their money and how they want to do it and spend it on what. But he grew up in Texas and learned about farming thanks to his grandparents who started there as sharecroppers. And then finally went on to become contract farmers for Del Monte. Mitch, however, is a perennial idea guy, a design thinker who is constantly pushing us on the conference team to expand our limits and our understanding of the ways that we can engage you, the audience. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Mitch Baranowski.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you so much. So honored to be here. What do you get when you transgenetically edit a really loud frog into an ear of corn? A frog horn. Get it? That's the best joke I could make up during Caleb's presentation. I know. You are all phenomes. You are all natural phenomes. We're going to create a designer climate in this room this morning. Are you ready? We're going to move from talk to action. And I am going to help nudge us down the road a piece with the help of this esteemed panel of experts who are going to inspire you with short remarks in turn. So let's get to it, shall we? First up, we're going to hear from Hari Pulapaka, and Hari is the executive chef and co-owner of a restaurant, an acclaimed restaurant, Cress Restaurant in Deland, Florida. And he's also not just a chef and co-owner of this restaurant, but a full-time tenured associate professor of mathematics and computer science at Stetson University. Hari?
Good morning, everyone. How are you? I can't tell you how much of an honor this is for me, because I've been coming to this event for several years now with my wife, the real doctor in the house, Dr. Pulapaka. And every time I come, I leave with so much more than what I came with. So my hope today, when I was tasked with being a provocateur to you, is to maybe not be that, because I feel like the morning has already had that effect perhaps on us, but rather leverage the idea that in this room we are consumers, and when we speak of what will consumers want and how do they think, perhaps we can just look within ourselves in trying to answer that question. So what I'm going to present to you is what I'm calling a 21-point Jiffy Lube solution to the idea of trying to promote and understand better how consumers think in the hopes of leveraging their power to make positive changes in our food system. So I began with the word consume. So it's seven letters, C-O-N-S-U-M-E. I'm kind of a nerd, as you can tell. And then I said, okay, well, if you divide seven into 21, you need three. And so I will take each letter and try to give you three words that to me evoke to me a better sense of perhaps trying to understand how we think as consumers and perhaps what we react to in terms of food especially, right? So C for cerebral, thought-provoking, deep, not shallow, coming from a place of mind. I come from a place of abstraction. I can't help it. I'm a mathematician. So when I think of things, when I have the luxury and time, I always come from a place of abstraction. And so hence, this is my approach to trying to give you some ideas. Choice, C for choice. Of course, this came up a number of times yesterday. Consumers want choice. So when we think of solutions and we think of ways of advocating for a better food system, we can't be mono-alphabetic, for lack of a better term. We must have several alphabets on the table. We must be poly-alphabetic. There must be lots of choices that all make sense and that all try to achieve the same general goal. C for clarity. Of course, mathematics is clear, and there can be no doubt. In the same way, I think our solutions, our ideas must have a sense of clarity. And what that means, of course, differs from how one approaches clarity, how one defines clarity. But at the very least, from the outside looking in, there should be a sense of clarity. There should be a sense of transparency. O for objective. Of course, I think objectively, generally speaking. I come from a place of subjection, of course. I'm an individual. I have a gut. So even though I say that I come from a place of abstraction, I also come from a place of gut. So, but yet, in trying to better understand our society from a consumption point of view, I think we must be objective. Organic. Our movement that's been, in place for some time now should understand when something is organic, something has a life of its own, and sort of we need to find ways to get out of the way when that's the case, and not try to sort of, impose ourselves and our biases on what's already happening in a good way. Open, naturally. This has come up a number of times this past 2 days, day and a half. We have to be open to a variety of ways of thinking about the same thing. And for nudge, the really nerdy part of me, Professor Richard Thaler just walked away with the 2017 Nobel Prize in Economics for his groundbreaking work and pioneering work in nudge theory, and the word nudge came up when Mr. Kahn spoke yesterday, and he alluded to the idea that you can't force this kind of stuff. This kind of stuff takes a long time. You have to nudge the consumers. So yeah, I think we do have to nudge our consumers, and by nudge our consumers, I mean nudge ourselves as well at the same time. We have to be nimble. We can't be steadfast. We have to be nimble. We have to be adaptive. We must nourish. Of course we nourish as chefs. We do that because we love to do that. It's what we know, what we do really well. We must nourish the ideas as well. As for science, of course, we must be scientific as much as we can be. And the previous session sort of took it to another level, clearly. But there is that. You must be aware of the science of how things happen. Satisfy. This came up yesterday with Chef Barber's panel. Leading from a place of taste. Leading with taste. We must satisfy. Satisfy the palate, satisfy the soul, satisfy the mind at the same time. Sustainable. Of course, it's the S word. We all like to use it. But sustainable, not about not the idea of the food system being sustainable, of course, but rather the activism being sustainable. We don't need band-aid solutions to things. We need sustainable ideas themselves, sustainable solutions themselves. Understanding, urgency. Notice I'm picking up the pace because I feel like I'm firing a ticket. It's 45 seconds. Understanding, urgency, unambiguity. Right? We must understand, we should have a sense of urgency as I'm having now, and we must be unambiguous, we must be clear. Motivation, media, mindfulness. Probably the most important one for me, mindfulness. Motivation, we need to understand what motivates us, what motivates consumers. We must take the fullest advantage of media, because they do that to us, I think media is at a critical mass, has reached in terms of its real potential, if you will, for making the kinds of things that we want to see in the world. And last but not least, education, empowered, and efficient, of course. And I'll leave you with this literary sort of mathematical fact, because I must, when you give talks in mathematics, it's customary to give a theorem and a proof. I won't subject you to that. But I will tell you that the number 21, the Jiffy Lube number 21, is kind of a cool number in so many ways. It's our wedding anniversary date, of course. It's my wife's birthday date, of course. So those are cool already. But if you add the integers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, which are 7 in all, you do get the number 21. It's a Fibonacci number. It's the smallest non-trivial Fibonacci number whose digits are also Fibonacci digits. So there you have it. Thank you.
Thank you, Hari. You had me at polyalphabetic. Next, let's hear from Pam Cook. Pam leads the Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy at Columbia University, which, focuses on the connections between a just, sustainable food system and healthy eating. Please welcome Pam.
Thank you. So my big idea that I want to present is nourishing education, cultivating tomorrow. Many times during the summit, we have heard people say that we're the choir. We care about good food already, and how do we get more people to care about it? I propose that we build on the movement that is catching fire across our country and around the globe to make broad nutrition education that is experiences gardening, cooking, learning about the food system, understanding food and health, and working towards food justice, something that is baked in to kindergarten through 12th grade education. I'm extremely fortunate to work closely with Dr. Joan Gussow, who received the Leadership Award last night. So for those of you who are at the award dinner, I'm going to be putting her comment about inoculating our kids into practice. When food is integrated into the curriculum throughout schooling and is experiential, as well as thoughtful and analytical, this can accelerate the momentum for people to eat fresh, local, and delicious food that is less highly processed. Let's be clear, today's children are still steamrolled with sophisticated marketing for processed food and ubiquitous availability of irresistible and relatively inexpensive sweetened beverages, snack foods, and fast foods. And this kind of education has been percolating for over 100 years. In a 1922 book by someone named Mary Schwartz-Rose, who started our program, she said, "While many things contribute to health, sleep, fresh air, and exercise, for instance, the foremost consideration is food. This is recognized today as never before." Remember, this is 1922. "And those who regard their own welfare and desire to give their children the best possible equipment for the stress of modern life are asking how to choose food wisely. So many kinds of food are displayed in our markets, and so many placards offer warnings or advice about what to eat." That was 1922. In a 1959 booklet called Promising Practices for Nutrition Education in the Elementary School, it starts out by saying a third grade class asks the question, "Where does our food come from?" They learned from having a father come in who was a grocer and taking field trips to different places around the community, as well as putting into practice in their school cafeteria. Joan Gussow in 1980 had a piece in the Teachers College Record called Food and Nutrition Education, a Redefinition, in which she wrote, "Ready or not, nutrition educators may simply have to take on the food supply issue since no one else is doing so. But telling the whole truth, and telling the whole truth takes open conversations with everyone, teaching people about who eats and who does not and why, about what ought not to be eaten as well as what ought to, will make nutrition a politically charged subject. A subject that more than mathematics or reading or even history or social studies will collide early on with powerful economic interest. To teach the right things, simply to ask the right questions, is likely to prove unsettling to the largest single industry in the United States. However, not to do so is to continue to settle for ineffectiveness." So I want to talk about three goals. The first is to have great, broad nutrition education in schools. That includes experiences with cooking and gardening that students can have. Let me tell you about going to a school in Chicago just last week. The students were connecting their English and social studies standards to learning about the three sisters and making succotash, and then figuring out what ingredients they wanted to add to that and negotiating it as a group for what they wanted to add to their recipes. Second, we need to have excellent school meals that are connected to the cafeteria. My doctoral research, which was with Joan too, was having kids cook in the classroom what was served in school lunch. When they do that, they eat what's in school lunch. And for those of you who don't know, New York City, starting this school year, is now having universal free meals for all its children. And that's starting to build where everybody feels included and everybody can get a school lunch. Third, gardening experiences give kids great opportunities to get to grow food, experience food, and harvest and eat it. I want to share a story of one of my doctoral students, and what she did is she asked kids about what they wanted whether they wanted to eat salad or not, and one boy looked at her and said in question, like, "Well, of course, who wouldn't want to eat salad? And that's the kind of things that happen when kids get to cook food. And finally, then, as kids get older, if they have these experiences, they are able to take on things, such as thinking about what are the pros and cons of pesticides and what we want to do. So what we want is it to be baked into education, that we're talking to our teachers and our principals and everyone in education. So these kinds of experiences where kids get to grow food, cook food, think about food analytically, think about all these scientific questions, are just part of what they do in education. Thank you.
Suffer and succotash, Pam. Thank you. Some inspiring goals. Next, we're going to hear from Olivier Deschutes via video, because he couldn't make the trip from Europe, but he did take the time to share a few thoughts via video. Olivier was the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, and he's written a lot about economic and social rights and that intersection with food. And he's one of the 2017 James Beard Foundation Leadership Award honorees. Let's hear from Olivier.
Being Power is a fantastic title, I think, for the Food Summit 2017. And I'm very grateful to Mitchell Davis and others who thought about this title, this theme for this Food Summit. I think power is a topic that is usually not enough discussed when we speak about food systems reform. And misconceptions about power are plentiful. We think of power as necessarily central, necessarily to be exercised top-down, necessarily to be monopolized by some and thus denied to others. And we think of power as something solid, something concentrated in a small number of hands. But in fact, power can be understood very differently. It can be understood as liquid. It can be understood as something that exists wherever people decide to exercise their rights, to claim for others to be held accountable for their actions, and wherever people invent solutions in order to overcome the obstacles that they encounter. I'm struck today by two things. First of all, that the center of gravity of innovation in politics in the US has shifted to the city level, to the municipal level, sometimes to the state level. And that it is at those levels that food systems are gradually being reformed by some enlightened politicians, but especially by citizens taking their fate in their own hands. For example, many cities have joined the Fearless Cities Network, promising to do things against climate change, for sustainable food systems, for example, that the government is not demanding that they do, and indeed that the government sometimes actively seeks to obstruct. I'm struck by the fact that many cities have joined the Milan Urban Food Policy Pact, demonstrating a willingness to develop sustainable food systems at local level. I'm also struck by the fact that many ordinary women and men today are trying to invent solutions at a grassroots level. They develop vegetable gardens with their neighbors. They join short food chains, community-supported agriculture. They choose very carefully whom they buy the food from because they want to know their farmer and make sure that they are making a choice that is politically responsible. And that is how gradually the food system is being changed, not by decrees adopted by the federal government, not by new regulations necessarily intervening, but by ordinary women and men understanding that they have a role in shaping the food systems. I believe this is very important to capture the citizens' energy. I believe it can be a way to bridge the gap that has grown between elected politicians on the one hand and ordinary citizens on the other hand, particularly if we can develop means to make food democracy a reality. Food policy councils, as they've developed, mushrooming since the past 25 years at city level, at state level sometimes, and that are such an impressive phenomenon across America. Or simply the involvement of parents in deciding what menus the school canteens shall offer for their children. There are many other ways in which food democracy can become an everyday feature of our lives, and in which power rather than being left to be exercised by a handful of professional politicians, can become exercised by all of us, eaters, producers, co-producers, really, who are participants in the food system. So I would like to thank you for choosing this title, and I very much hope that it will lead to fruitful discussions today.
Yes. Oh, we thank Olivier for that. Each of us does have a role to play in changing our food system, which we will get to in the next half of this session together. If you've ever given up meat for Monday, then you know the Monday campaigns, perhaps. It's my pleasure now to welcome Peggy New, the president of the Monday campaigns, a global movement aimed at encouraging healthy, sustainable behaviors. Peggy.
So I am really excited to share some news that happened yesterday here in New York City. Mayor de Blasio held a press conference downtown where he announced that Meatless Monday is being introduced in 15 schools in Brooklyn with the hope of rolling it out next year. And the second thing that he said was that he was going to start practicing Meatless Monday at home with his family and also in Gracie Mansion. Now, that doesn't seem to be too difficult because he shared with us that his kids and his wife are vegetarian. However, he did say something that I think goes to the core of what the Meatless Monday concept is all about, and that is, he said, "We're starting a new habit, and it's something I'm really looking forward to." And so I'd like to talk about Meatless Monday and how it can help create habits, and also how it can create a sense of citizenship. Before I get into that, though, I did want to talk a little bit about the history, because there's actually another big anniversary. It's the 100th anniversary of the original concept of Meatless Monday. And this was during World War I, and it was part of the Food Will Win the War initiative. And basically, citizens were called on to do their patriotic duty to give up meat once a week, and there was also a Wheatless Wednesday. And the idea was to conserve food for the troops. And victory gardens were also practiced during that time. It was then brought back in World War II because it was so successful. And then the modern Meatless Monday came back in 2003, and it was founded by Sid Lerner, a former advertising executive, and the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. So when it did come back, it was back for a very different reason than how it was practiced and why it was practiced during the World Wars. Rather than not enough, we really have a problem now of too much. And in the case of meat, that is really creating very serious consequences. You know, for health, when it just first started in 2003, it was about saturated fat in the diet. But since then, the body of research that's been developed linking a high meat diet with obesity and diabetes and cancers has really grown. And as the rest of the world starts to adopt our high meat diet, those problems are being exported around the world. And the second part of it is just the impact of meat on the environment. Meat production takes up an enormous amount of arable land and water, and animal agriculture actually contributes 15% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So experts say if we continue on this course, the meat consumption will double by 2050, and it will be very hard, if not impossible, to achieve the climate goals set out in Paris. So partly because of those reasons, you know, the Meatless Monday has really grown. It's now in 40 countries. It's practiced by restaurants, chefs, home cooks. And it's really been carried forth on the back of these advocates because there are so many reasons to cut back on meat. You know, whether it's the environment or health or animal welfare. But a core part of it has really been the leadership of chefs, because when it comes down to it, it's food and it has to taste good. And one of the things people really struggle with is, like, what to make. If I'm not going to have meat, what do I eat? So that's part of what we do with Meatless Monday. So back to habit and citizenship. There are a couple of things about the Meatless Monday concept that make it very powerful. One is it's so simple. You just say Meatless Monday and you get it. Two, it's all about baby steps. We're not trying to make everyone vegetarians and vegans just one day a week. And then the third thing is really about Monday. Monday fits effortlessly in the weekly cycle, which really dictates our planning and menus and promotional cycles. And also, the Monday is really the day that people are most open to doing healthy behavior. We've done a lot of research. People search for health information on the internet. They start diets. They start exercise regimens. So basically, by hitching a health behavior of going meatless to the week, you can reach people when they're most open to buy, and then you can sustain that healthy behavior over time. So I think, though, to close, one of the most powerful aspects of Meatless Monday is that it provides a social context for change. So basically, because it's a specific time and people are together in a specific place, you can do it together. And even if you're not physically together, the fact that you're taking this small step with people all over the world, from Iran to Israel to Kuwait, you can feel connected in this common mission of this shared ritual. So anyway, these problems can sometimes feel overwhelming, but I think what Meatless Monday shows us is, you know, if together we take small steps, we can have a big impact on a lot of different issues. So thank you.
Thanks, Peggy. Thank you, Peggy. TGIM. Chef Phil Jones is an alum of the James Beard Foundation's Chef's Boot Camp, but he really works at the intersection of high-quality, nutritionally dense food and community growth. And he does that with a sense of justice and opportunity for all. With City Food Community Concepts, he is endeavoring to make this mission real in his hometown of Detroit. Please welcome Phil.
Thank you. Thank you. And I have to get my ducks in a row, being a good Jesuit product here. Hold on a second. Let me go here. Who's familiar with Afrofuturism? There's a few of you out here. Very quickly, 1993, a brother, Mark Deary, a journalist, coined the phrase Afrofuturism, really referring to a comic book genre. But since then, it has become so much more. It is actually a way of looking forward to some systems inside of Afrocentric world to move us forward. And inside of these conversations, there's literature, there's art, there's a lot of things, and food was never really a big part of it. So what we're trying to do with City Food Community Concepts, my wife and I, are we're trying to add food to this conversation. So why is this important? Black food is jacked up. And let me back up real quick. I have to apologize in advance for a couple things. One, I'm a chef, so I'm going to try to not drop any F-bombs, but it might happen. And two, I am weather affected, and I just ask you to bear with me because I just have something physically that happens with weather changes. Black food is messed up. Black food in America is in a sad state of affairs. I am a living example of that. I'm a chef who cooks food and loves food, but I don't have a really good relationship with it, as many of black folks do. Same thing is going on in Africa. Africa has a lot of food issues, and we need to fix these things. So as we look back, we look in these, both of these food systems have something that's very common, and that's the diaspora, the ripping of a people from a land and moving them somewhere else. Those who remain had their future taken away, and those who were taken away had their past taken away. So that has created a lot of issues, unemployment, obesity health issues, land wealth issues. And so we need to actually address these things. So what we have to do is we have to create some kind of therapeutic intervention. We have to get in there, jump in there, and treat this like an ailment. In dealing with someone as sick, you have to get to them and you have to stop the bleeding. So that's the triage. Get in, stop the bleeding. Then there's a treatment portion, and inside of this treatment portion, you look to see what are the causes, and you create a plan of action. And the third portion of this intervention is the healing and the regrowth portion. So with that said, both food systems have this common goal, common issue in the diaspora, and so you can't fix either food system without fixing the other at the same time. So what we're trying to do is to look forward in new systems to address both food systems at the same time. So inside of this, this is the weather part, sorry about this. Inside of this, we're trying to develop systems that work for folks. And so we have, with me and my wife today, we have an example of that. And this is young man over here, is Akello Karamoko. He is the leader of a group of folks that we have, we call it the Good Food Ambassadors. These young folks go into the grocery stores and they talk to people as they're actually shopping to help them make food decisions before it's too late. Once the food hits your refrigerator, it's there, it's gonna be consumed. So Kello and our young folks go in and actually intervene. We also have with us Brenda Mtuma today. Brenda is works with the USDA and she is moving forward the SNAP issues and dealing with the future of food through the SNAP program. You know what, folks? I'm sick. My community's sick. My family's sick. Our world is sick. Black folks were ripped away from the land, and we're suffering now. And so Afrofuturism is a way of addressing these issues with a certain sense, thank you, with a certain sense of place and being. The work that we do with City Food Community Concept is based on the belief that we can change our food systems by using tools that we're given and that we have available to us. While our system is broken, there are a lot of wonderful shining lights, and these two young folks are examples of that. Inside of African food, inside of black food, there are recipes, there are ingredients, there are traditions, and all of these things exist, but they're not being promoted and given the space that they should be given. You would never know that there's grand food histories inside of Africa. The French aren't the only ones that can cook. The Italians aren't the only ones that can cook. The Spanish aren't the only ones that can cook. And all of these things have been influenced by African food. So what we're looking to do is to promote African food from Africa to the Americas, making sure that people want to really realize the wonderful impact that African food has had in the world and the wonderful impact that it can have and the changes that it can be that can be done by this. So we are working to promote this food from Africa to America to really create a model that can be used in marginalized communities around the world. And it's not just black folks that are having problems, it's people that have been taken advantage of their entire life because greed, colonialism, and oppression have really ruled our food systems. So what we're really trying to do is to bring people together, bring you all together to be a part of this process, because inside of this, we heard from Caleb today and this wonderful program where it's kind of crowdsourcing ideas and ambitions. We have the Meatless Monday thing going. We work with youth, they're called the Food Warriors. And so what we're doing is we have a Meatless Monday program where they're gonna introduce their parents into the process. We're doing things on the ground, and we're doing things that are really tangible. Mitch asked for actions, and I'll be able to talk a little bit better, but there are actions that we are taking right now, and I'm going to sit, and if you have questions, it'll be easier for me to answer that way.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks, Phil. Thank you, Phil. You remind us of the resiliency of the human spirit. Thank you for that. I'll leave you with this thought. If we want to change things, at a high level, change is about innovation plus leadership. We need to disrupt, take risks on infrastructure, policy, and demand, what Eric talked about yesterday, and we need to combine that with courage, conviction, and vision. Innovation plus leadership equals change. I'll leave you with that delta. Enjoy your break. See you in 25 minutes. Thank you, everybody.
I'm just trying to get to you with all those mathematical references.
I'm trying, man.
We're entering the final act, really, of the summit. I didn't realize until I put all of the pieces today together that our theme for today is provocation, really. We began with Caleb Harper provoking us to think about things we can't even imagine, let alone realize that are happening. And we have, throughout the morning, had an opportunity to be provoked and to think provocatively about individuals with real issues, with real aspirations, some of them having nothing at all to do with food, perhaps, but certainly people who need to eat. We're going to close today with two further provocations, and these we hope will expand our minds even further and leave us with new perspectives on this notion of the consumer. Someone who has been traveling this country provoking people to think differently in so many different ways around and through food is Tunde Wey. He's a Nigerian cook, a writer, an activist who moved to the United States when he was 16. He's been exploring issues of race and immigration and gentrification with a series of dinners called Blackness in America, and also a series called 1882. I was fortunate to participate in one of those dinners in Philadelphia, and we've often prided ourselves with this conference by making people feel a little uncomfortable when they leave, hopeful and optimistic, but uncomfortable. Well, I've never felt more uncomfortable than having left that Blackness dinner because of reasons I think you're about to hear. Tunde is an eloquent speaker, an academic, a very talented cook, and we're very fortunate to welcome him to the stage. Please, Tunde Wey.
Thank you guys for having me here. I appreciate it. I want to thank Mitchell and Ashley especially for making me here possible. My flights were canceled and she made it happen, so thank you. I'm not sure if anybody has been here and started with a song, but I want to, if that's okay. So can we all sing together? That was not a rhetorical question. That's real. All right. So I'm going to clap, and you guys just join me. Siro gbain, siro gbain, so gbain, so gbain. Alama de wuye, alama de wuye, de wuye, de wuye. O sibo game around, o sibo game around, o game around, o game around. Akpana akpanubi, akpana akpanubi, panubi, panubi. Ebis, 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 ebis. Thank you. That song is from my mother's childhood. She taught me the song when I was a kid. And my mom is from Nigeria, the Delta area. And there are a bunch of tribes in that sort of like situation. One of the tribes are Urobo, and they have a poetic form wherein the reciter critiques himself as a way to critique society. And the idea is that you can't change anything until you purge yourself, right? So I'm going to be here in front of you purging myself first. I started my dinner series in the spring of 2016 as a response to the then publicized killings of unarmed black folks. And I moved here from Nigeria. I'm black, as you guys can see. But being Nigerian and being black is different from being American and being black. There's a different sort of like historical context. And so I started this dinner series to understand for myself what blackness meant in America when, in America, blackness had been politicized. And so this sort of like inquiry into blackness very quickly went from that to a query of white supremacy, which is this thing, this force that has continuously subjugated people of color. And in doing these dinners, what I came to realize was that I was developing a very healthy pessimism. I didn't feel like racial reconciliation was possible. because I would do these very simple tests. I would ask folks in a room where they weren't obligated to give anything. I would say, hypothetically, you know, we understand that we live in a zero-sum world, and the more people get, the less other people receive, and that historically this country has been built on white supremacy, and that is a power that comes from the exploitation of people of color. So without, you know, any sort of duress, what are folks willing to give up? And the answer was usually nothing. And so I would do the dinners, and I would just get more and more sort of pessimistic. And I wanted to understand for myself why this pessimism bothered me. And sort of in examining my own life and my own reality, I came to see myself as, in a sense, the analog of whiteness and white supremacy that I was critiquing in my own relationships as a man, because that's what I am, even though sometimes I act like a boy. But as a man, I very slowly and unfortunately realized that my relationships have been fraught with patriarchy and misogyny. And I would go into detail, but my wife she's watching this live stream, so I don't want to say all that. But that realization was the basis of my pessimism, because despite knowing that I embody this privilege, and not just privilege in an antiseptic sense, but privilege in a destructive sense, one that creates tension and havoc in my relationships, I still find it difficult to change, you know, because it feels good to get what I want when I want to. So even though I know, like, intellectually, emotionally, that I should change and I should be different, I find it difficult. And this was the basis of the pessimism that I felt around race in America, because I identified myself as the problem. So why am I saying all this stuff when we're talking about what's the theme of the conference? Consuming power. So I think there are two ways to read the theme, right? And I missed the conference, my apologies. But I'm assuming that the first read is probably what has been spoken about here. It's like, we are consumers, we have great transactional power, and we can use this power for good. We can change the world. And in this frame, like, we see ourselves as the protagonists, and this is sweet. But then when I just, like, said the words over and over again, a different read came up: consuming power. And when you read it that way, then the idea shifts, and then we are consumers of power. And the reason why we consume is to maintain power, is to accumulate power. And in this read, we are the protagonists, the villains. And in my own personal reflection, my understanding has been that to create change, to create transformation, that we can't do this, you know, thing that people say we should do, is imagine ourselves in the other person's shoes. Those other person's shoes have been filled. We need to imagine ourselves in our own shoes and understand that we are the problem, that we are the villain. And so when we think about food, and we think about consuming food, and we think about all of the inputs that go into that, we think about land that was appropriated, taken from indigenous peoples, and then tilled by enslaved peoples, and then unevenly distributed, and now commercially farmed. Or we think about labor that has always been precarious and underpaid, and capital, which has been deployed to fund these products that we consume. But its deployment is only focused exclusively on profit at the expense of people and the planet. Then we have to, like, come to this place that says consumption is not a virtue. Consumption is not righteous. And in fact, consumption can only be, at best, a compromise. It's a compromise that we've made because we live in a place, in a society where we have to sort of like do certain things. We have to shop, we have to eat. But then there has to be, I guess, a way to move away from despair, to move away from pessimism. And this is, I guess, where I am personally and where maybe I'm encouraging us to be, is to move from despair. We have to think away from consumption and to contribution. And, you know, I guess that sounds pithy to say, but I think there's a way to actualize that. And we have to think not of what we can take, but what we can give, and give specifically by giving up. Because I think the only way that we change things, the only way that we can transform things away from this idea, which is problematic, that when we consume, we can somehow change, which is not true. Because when we consume, all we're doing is reinforcing the tyranny that already exists. What we have to do is give up power. The only way that things can change is if power changes hands. And power has to change hands to people who have been historically dispossessed. And those people who the transfer is made to have to be working on alternate and inclusive modes of production, of reproduction, of contribution. I used to, a long, long time ago, practice Buddhism. And there's this phrase that has stuck with me. It is consistency from beginning to end. And I think that we are comfortable with the idea of consumption being a tool for change because, like I said, it reinforces this idea of the protagonist that is us. But if we look at our choices and we understand that, yes, we do, you know, we buy organically or we source our food from our restaurants from the closest, you know, smallest, most eco-friendly farm, you know, but yet our generosity doesn't apply to education, right? That we can comfortably source food locally but still have our children educated in segregated schools. That we can say Black Lives Matter but are unconcerned with the racial wealth disparity in this country. Unconcerned beyond just saying I'm concerned, but unconcerned because we don't do anything about it. So what this means is that we don't actually believe that consumption changes anything. We believe that consumption reinforces what we have, and we want to keep what we have. But if we really want to change, and I think that's what we're all here for, then we have to give that shit up. And the way to give that shit up is to give power to, again, folks who have historically been dispossessed, not as charity, not even as restitution, but as the only way to make what we want, which is, you know, a healthy community, more sustainable and viable. So thank you very much for letting me speak.
At the last session of this summit. Thank you, Tunde, for a wonderful, inspiring, we've used the word mindfulness here a lot. I think if I was counting words and adding up which word was said the most in public, I think besides things like and, but, you, me, I think mindful and mindfulness would float up to the top of the list. So thank you for allowing us also to increase our mindfulness. And so now I am going to introduce John Alexander. John, as you will hear, is from the UK. John, after you look up his bio and you can see all the wonderful things and amazing things that John has done and learned and so many admirable things, but possibly nothing more admirable than leaving the advertising agency world and starting an organization called the New Citizenship Project, which over the last several years has been looking at reframing the way that people engage with different sectors and different shapes and sizes of power. And we've asked John to come over here from England to share with us some work that he's been doing on the notion of food and citizenship. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome John.
Hello.
It's a real honor to be doing this last talk, and I want to thank everybody, Karen and Mitchell in particular, for inviting me and having me here. The way I want to do these closing remarks is really to offer I think we're all feeling pretty full, metaphorically, of some wonderful kind of stimulus and provocation over the last day and a half. And so I hope what I'm going to offer is something by way of a digestive, of something that maybe will help settle some of what you've heard over the last day and a half into a bit of a pattern, help you make a bit more sense of it. And the way I want to do that is I want to share the story, the model that we've developed at the New Citizenship Project as the story we tell about where we are as a society and the way we understand what's going on right now, because it's a pretty confusing time. And that story is built out of three simple little words, subject, consumer, and citizen. And basically, this story is about saying the way we think society works isn't the way it works. The way we tend to think our society works is that we're consumers and citizens and shareholders and parents and employers and employees and parents, and we move between these roles pretty seamlessly. We move between them at different times. And what we think is going on actually is that it works slightly differently. That at any given time, there's one of these roles that sits up above all those and informs all of them with its logic, how we perform all of them with its logic. And this is a kind of quasi-historical narrative. So go back to the beginning, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. That dominant story, that sort of up here story, was something like the subject. So the right thing for us to do as individuals in society at that time was to get what we were given, to keep our heads down, to kind of do as we were told, to just do our duty. And if everyone did that, then the best society would result. And that logic kind of fell apart in the early 20th century. And coming out of the two world wars, a different story of who we are as individuals and what the right thing to do is kind of bubbled up and came through. And that's something like the consumer. So if subject is keep your head down, do as you're told, consumer is something like look out for number one. Get the best deal for yourself. Choose the best option for you from those that are offered. And if everyone does that, then the best society will result. It's a moral idea. And what we think is happening right now is that just as the subject story fell apart, the consumer story is falling apart now. That logic is kind of crumbling in on itself. And what's bubbling, super excitingly, is something like the citizen. A logic that says the right thing to do is actually to get involved, to shape the context of your own life, not just to choose between the options, but to shape what the options are. And just to say, so there are kind of two things that shift, two aspects of power, actually, that shift between these three roles. As subjects, we have no real creative power. We just get what we're given. We have no real moral power. We can't choose anything. We have no agency. As consumers, we have more power, more creative power. But we have the freedom to choose. We can choose between the options, and we have more moral power. We are good enough to know what's best for ourselves as individuals. As citizens, though, we have more. Even more power than that. We have the power not just to choose between the options that are offered, but to shape what those options are. And we have the opportunity not just to, we are good enough in ourselves, not just to know what's best for us as individuals, but to play a part in the discussion about what's best for the society as a whole. So we think this is what's going on, but let me tap in, because this is backed up. I'm a kind of academic jack of all trades and master of none, and one of the things that we've dug into is some of the social psychology around some of this. And I think this plays really powerfully to why the story of the consumer is kind of crumbling in on itself right now. And I want to tell you about two studies that we've done. The first was it was a water resource dilemma, and this was a study first done by a team of social psychologists at Northwestern University back in 2012. And what they did was they gave a resource dilemma to a group of people. They said, right, you're one of four households dependent on a single well for your water supply, and that well is starting to run dry. And then they said, And then they ask two questions. So well starting to run dry, you need to use less water. They ask two questions. Firstly, to what extent are you prepared to use less water? And secondly, to what extent do you trust the other three households to use less water? Now, the clever bit is that for half the sample, they replace the word household with the word consumer. So you're one of four consumers depending on a single well for your water supply. To what extent do you trust the other consumers? The people for whom the word is consumer are significantly less likely to trust each other and significantly less likely to be willing to compromise. A single word, unconsciously processed. We replicated this study with a sample of 2,000 people and had the same results. This idea of who we are is even in a single word, can shape our behavior and our motivations. We've done this. We've done loads of similar studies. This data is from one where we asked 3,000 people two questions. Firstly, to what extent do you think it's important to participate actively in society? And secondly, to what extent do you think it's important to be involved in your local community? The control group was simply asked those two questions. The citizen group, the 1,000 people, before they saw those two questions, we asked them, to what extent do you think everyone is born equal? To what extent do you agree that everyone's born equal? And the consumer group, before they were asked those two questions, we asked them, to what extent do you agree it's important to find brands that fit your personality? This data is controlling for the extent of agreement with the prior question. So if you see the question, to what extent do you think it's important to find brands that fit your personality, you're then less likely to agree that it's important to be involved, to participate actively in local society or be involved in your local community. Equally, if you see the question, to what extent do you ever agree everyone's born equal, you're more likely to agree with those questions. And what we do, what we say with this is we think about where we are. I worked in the advertising industry for a decade, and the question I came to ask myself was, what are we doing to ourselves when we tell ourselves we're consumers something like 3,000 odd times a day? We surround ourselves with this story, and we tell it to ourselves in organizations as well. And when we tell ourselves, when we speak about people, even in rooms like this, when we speak about people as consumers, we're setting ourselves on a path that means we can't possibly imagine what people could really do. We're setting ourselves on a path that limits what people can do. And then we speak to people in that way, and then they respond like this. We condition the response that's the worst of people. And this is why we're in this spiral right now, I believe. But this is the hopeful part. It's reflected slightly in this data, maybe. Like, the gap between the control group and the citizen group is relatively small. And this taps into the idea and a big revolution that's going on in our understanding of human nature right now, that actually people are fundamentally empathic. People are driven by, as much by empathy and collaboration as by competition and status. We have a new story that's building, and it's coming out of some funny places. Has anyone seen this image before? This comes from a TED talk that became very famous by a guy called Franz De Waal, who's an animal behavior specialist. And in this talk, this image is from a study that was published under the title "Monkeys Demand Equal Pay for Equal Work." And it's a beautiful thing. I highly recommend watching it. Basically, very short version of what happens. Two Capuchin monkeys, they do a task and get given a reward. The first hands a stone through the window and is given a piece of cucumber, eats the cucumber. Second monkey hands a stone through the window and is given a grape, eats the grape. Now, Capuchin monkeys prefer grapes to cucumber, and they've seen each other. Go back to the first monkey, hands a stone through the window, is given cucumber again. This time, looks at cucumber, throws cucumber back at researcher. But the fascinating thing is that in a significant proportion of the experiments, the monkey given the grape starts to refuse the grape. Solidarity among monkeys. And this it's a phenomenal thing. When I was developing these ideas, when we're starting to play around with this and go, what's going on here? What are we doing to ourselves with this work? Sitting at a desk in an advertising agency, and I still some of my best friends. I don't celebrate leaving those things behind in too many ways. But there was a particular boss of mine who wasn't the most constructive supporter of my work. And what he said to me was at one point was, John, you've got to give up on this stuff. Humans are just nasty monkeys. Consumerism's evolution. And what I can say to him now is not even monkeys are just nasty monkeys. Like, this is, it's a beautiful thing for me. So, but if this is some sort of theoretical evidence that there's something in humanity that is bigger and better than the idea of the consumer, the most impactful stuff is when we look out into the world and see that this is actually happening. I'm not making a moral argument, I'm making a trend argument. But and that's not to say we don't have to do something about it, but it is something that's going on. And we tend to look at this in three different ways, across communities that are sort of starting to self-organize and see themselves as come together as citizens to refuse to wait for government structures to move for them, but actually to organize for themselves. Government and the sort of phenomenon of participatory democracy that's bubbling up around the world, then the moments when governments actually start to, and governance structures start to reach out to those people and create the frameworks for that impact to be bigger. And in the world of business, where actually there's a much more powerful business model in this way of thinking of people. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of my favorite kind of trend spot examples, firstly from outside, across those three, firstly from outside the food industry and then within the food industry. So my first, Ashley, I tinkered with the way I wanted to tell this story late notice, and Ashley, who's been arranging a lot of this, said, I'm going to let you get away with it because you've put a picture of David Bowie in. So this is the Brixton £10 note, and this for me is the phenomenon of local currency. There are now something like 4,000 local currencies, complementary currencies in circulation around the world. And the way complementary currencies work, local currencies work, is that they're pegged against the national currency at a favorable exchange rate that means that combats the economies of scale and means that you can shop in your local community at the same economic personal impact, but it retains the money circulating in the local economy and sustains that economy. And people are just creating these things. They're not waiting for any structure to happen. They're self-organizing. They're taking the power to shape the structures of their lives into their own hands. In food, that we've heard already this in the last day and a half about some phenomenal examples of exactly this kind of self-organizing. I mean, having Phil Jones on the stage he embodies it in a lot of ways. But my favorite, the one I wanted to share with you, is the Incredible Edible Network, a sort of self-generating network of grassroots community activists who are creating public food and public land, planting fruit and vegetables in public land around in villages and towns around the world. And it started in a working class town in northern England, where the sort of deprivation is pretty high and has been the root of some of the political upheaval that you've seen your own version of over here, and it's a very different response to that. Moving into formal politics and the sort of rise of participatory democracy, my favorite example from outside the food system is this project in Iceland called Better Reykjavik. It's essentially a really simple online forum where any citizen of Reykjavik can propose an idea for how the city could be better. And people upvote and downvote and chip in their own ideas. The fascinating thing about this is that there's an explicit contract with the city administration where 15 ideas a month are debated by the city council in a special session of the council with a predisposition that they will be enacted. So there is a meaningful contract of power between the citizen and their ideas, and we were hearing about this from Jennifer Kuzma earlier, that this thing that in food policy that in the States and in the UK as well, there may be public engagement, there's relatively few contracts of power. That's different in Better Reykjavik, and as a result, something like 70% of the population of the city have participated in this platform. In food, we've talked about, Olivier was in his video link was talking about food policy councils. Again, Phil Jones, a representative of Detroit Food Policy Council. We've seen so many of these. My favorite example that built on those is the story behind the mandate for a new food policy, a new holistic food policy for Canada, which grew out of the Food Policy Council's network in Canada, bubbled into a series of kitchen table talks around the country, and then a people's food policy called Resetting the Table, and then a campaign called Eat, Think, Vote, which mobilized people to challenge their representatives in the forthcoming election to prioritize a new holistic food policy for Canada, and came through as one of the first actions that Justin Trudeau took. Into business, and I wanted to mention the B Corporation movement as in business, this shift in logic from consumer to citizen is at the level of business and also at the level of the relationship between business and its customers. Businesses as consumers of society, the logic is that your role, the right thing to do, the responsibility of business is to maximize its profits. in this world of businesses, citizens in society, the responsibility of businesses to sustain the communities that they're part of. And that's what B Corporations, with the logic of having to nominate a purpose that you exist to serve beyond profit, you reorient this, the entire structure of business to say profit is a means to fulfilling purpose rather than vice versa. The quick story I wanted to tell in the context of food is one of my favorite organizations. You guys are going to be seeing a lot more of them over here. They've just moved across the Atlantic. BrewDog, we've heard a bit about the craft beer phenomenon. BrewDog is a wonderful, fascinating organization. They effectively invented the concept of equity crowdfunding back in 2007 before any of the platforms existed. And they're owned by, they've raised now, they're into their fifth equity crowdfunding round. They've raised something like £40 million through this model. And the fascinating, what they do though is they don't see people as customers or as consumers, they see people as participants in their mission to make other people as passionate about great craft beer as we are. They run training courses for a qualification called the Cicerone, which is like a sommelier but for beer. They have an annual general meeting of all these people who've bought into this equity crowdfunding scheme. They call it annual general mayhem. It's 6,000 people descend on a brewery in Scotland every year and have an enormous party. But they also do the business of an AGM. They see these people actually as their stakeholders, as their participants. They rethink the whole structures. So these are just a couple of examples, and there are many, many more that I could share. But what I want to leave you with is just an action that you might take as one thing to take away with you that's a really simple start point in being part of this new story, and a question that you can think about. And the action is this: wherever you possibly can, don't use the word consumer. I'm not saying people don't consume, but there is a really vital difference between the verb and the noun. We can be citizens who consume, but when we become consumers who might or might not vote, that's a totally different orientation to society, and it's a really dangerous one. So challenge yourself. Am I using the language that I should? Can I break out? Can I talk about people? I don't insist you use the word citizen, but don't use the word consumer if you possibly can. A few prompts just to think about. We have this table in our report where we talk about the shift from subject, consumer, citizen. Subjects are dependent, consumers independent, citizens interdependent. Subjects have stuff done to them, consumers have stuff done for them, citizens have do stuff with you. Subjects obey, consumers demand, citizens participate, receive, choose, create. And the role of organizations in a subject era to command, in a consumer era to serve, in a citizen era to facilitate. And it springs to mind that there's a Burundian saying that I find very powerful and we use in our work an awful lot of the time, which is that anything you do for me without me, you do to me. And I think we could all do with remembering that. Finally, this is our kind of way of saying, I'm not naive. I know that we live in a moment, and I said at the beginning, we live in a moment of deep uncertainty and big change. I believe that we are currently somewhere in this line where the consumer era is coming down, but it's still the dominant story. The story we live in, the story we're surrounded by, is still the story of the consumer. But there is something forming. And the opportunity for us all is to jump off that yellow curve and onto that pink curve and be part of something different. And the question I wanted to leave you with to maybe help you think about how you might do that is, what would I do and what would my organization do if we really, really believed that people are citizens, not just consumers? If we believed that people can and want to, in their heart of heart, in the deepest of human nature, everyone can and wants to participate in shaping a better society, rather than believing that people are fundamentally selfish and lazy. Challenge yourself to hold that thought and see what you would do with it. I'm going to leave you very last thing with a quote that from a woman called Rebecca Solnit, who wrote a fabulous book called Hope in the Dark, which Tunde's talk just made me think about so much, about the difference between optimism and pessimism and the space between. And she talks about the space between as being hope. And she says, hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. When you recognize uncertainty, you recognize that you may be able to influence the outcomes. You alone, or you in concert with a few dozen or several million others. Hope is an embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will all be fine without our involvement. Pessimists adopt the opposite position. Both excuse themselves from acting. It is the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when it may matter, who and what it may impact, are not things that we can know beforehand. Thank you very much for having me.